For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so if you've got a Bible, we're going to be in the book of 1 Peter, chapter 2. And we've been studying through this book now for a while. And the context, which you know pretty well by now if you've been here, is that the audience is, they're suffering. They're enduring what our author, Peter, calls a fiery ordeal. That's why I picked a fiery background. Okay, just connecting the dots for you. It's fiery and ominous. And the problem is that they are facing a headwind in their culture. They're facing opponents who are beginning to ostracize and mistreat and exclude them. It's really the beginning of a wave of persecution. And they're suffering with this. And last week, talked about them being rejected. They're being rejected by their communities, by the people in their lives, and the incredible difficulty, you know, what you go through when you face rejection. And so tonight, he keeps right on rolling with this, you know, these instructions, this encouragement. Here's how you live in the face of a fiery ordeal like this. And so let's read. Starting here in chapter 2, verse 11, he says, "Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation." So he starts off, there's kind of a breaking point here. There's a transition in the book because he kind of clears his throat and gets their attention again. "Beloved," you know, he's like, "Guys, listen." And you know it's going to be heavy when someone calls you beloved. You know, like when you're a kid and your parents like, "Okay, son," you know, and you're like, "Uh-oh, here we go." Especially if they remind you, "Son, I love you." You know, it's like, okay, this next part's going to be hard to hear. "Beloved," he says, "I urge you." And this is a little bit of a different mood as well. The last four or five studies we've done have mostly been a lot of encouragement, a lot of reminding them, here's who you are, here's who God is, you belong to Him, here's why this is happening, here's what to put your hope on, and remember, you know, he's been giving them all these reminders, but now he's like, okay, guys, now I'm going to start urging you. Now I have something for you to do. Now I have instructions for you to follow, and I want you to take them seriously. So it becomes much more practical, I think, from this point. And he urges them as aliens and strangers, which ought to ring a bell, because he's called them that earlier in the passage. It's really a pretty good way of summarizing all the things that he's said up to this point, that they belong to God, that their citizenship is in heaven, and they ought to think of themselves as those who belong to Christ and have been sent into this world but don't really belong in this world. All the freight of all those ideas, he wants to keep that all in mind, remembering all that, "I urge you." And then he starts telling them some things to do. He says, "Abstain from fleshly lusts, which wage war against the soul." And honestly, that's kind of review too. That came up earlier. He's describing, you know, fleshly lusts in the context of this book. Those are our selfish desires. Those are the things that we live for apart from God, that we try to quench our thirst with. That's how you used to live before you knew Christ, he's already told them. That's how the world lives apart from God. He's like, that's who you were. That's what everyone else does. But you're aliens and strangers, so don't do that. Abstain from that. Instead, so he's saying it negatively, and now here's his point positively, the main point. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. I urge you to keep your behavior excellent. I hate the word behavior because it means I have to do something. But what he has in view here is our conduct. It's like how you behave. how you live, what you do. He says, keep that excellent. And there's an audience that he has in mind too. He says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, which is really just, it's probably an idiom for the outside world. You know, you guys are this community that's under fire. You're sticking out like a sore thumb. You're getting abused for it. Keep your behavior excellent among, you know, before all those who are watching in the world around you. And so what I really think that he's saying here, he's asking them to be mindful of what they're showing the world by what they do. Show Christ to the world by what you do. I think that is the essence of this passage. I think it's the main point. That when it comes to presenting ourselves to the world and when it comes to presenting Jesus Christ to the world, it's really about what we do, how we behave and how we act. And so Peter gives us, I think, three things about this. First of all, the why. Why should I care how my behavior looks to the watching world around me? Then he gives them two concrete examples, like ways they can have excellent behavior in their context, which we'll read about. And then thirdly, what I call a but wait, which is like you read all this and you're like, hold on a minute, God, I got a problem with this. So that's what we're going to do. You ready? All right, let's go. The why. Why should I care what anyone thinks about what I do or how I live? He says, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. The reason that they should keep excellent behavior is because they're being slandered, it says, slandered as evildoers. And slander, it literally means to speak evil of, to speak against someone, and like with evil intent. I think it also implies dishonesty. You know, I'm talking trash about you. I'm saying things against you. I'm trying to tear you down with my words. That's slander. And so he's saying you guys are being slandered, and that's why you need to keep your behavior excellent. Slander is pretty hard to take. I don't know if you've ever been slandered. It's not that fun. I've been accused of things before unfairly. I've been mischaracterized, and I'll just be honest with you. I don't handle it well. Here, I'll give you a funny example to start. We'll start light. We're on a road trip a while back, me and my wife and some friends. And I, you know how there's those like rumble strips along the lanes? Well, I hit one of those and it was like, and then like 5 minutes later, I did it again. And so they started being like, Ben, are you tired? And I was like, no, I'm not tired. I'm fine. Like, are you sure? Do you want me to trade off with you? I'm like, no, I'm good. Well, then there was a car on the side of the road, so I had to kind of go around him, and it was like, and they're like, Ben, are you falling asleep? And I'm like, no, I'm not tired. Okay, changing lanes. They're like, Ben. And I started to get so mad, and I was like, I'm not tired, okay? Don't say, and I like, you know, and I realized, like, why am I so mad? I'm so mad about this. Why? Because slander is why. It's a dirty lie. I'm wide awake. You see how much coffee I drink? You know, I am wide awake. Made me mad. So, you know, the point here is when that happens, when you get slandered, what you do is a lot more important than what you say. It's actually very hard to talk yourself out of slander. It's like quicksand. The more I argued that I was wide awake, the more that they saw that it was hilarious to say that I was tired. So I was like, all right, I'm never going to hit one of those strips again. You know, I was like, I'm going to be the best driver ever. I was completely focused. And I was so focused that I blew right past our exit. and of course, there wasn't another one for like 5 miles, you know. And I'm driving, I'm just like, oh God, they're going to notice. And all of a sudden they're like, Ben, why is the GPS telling you to turn around? Like, are you tired? Okay, talk is cheap. That's the point. What you do says everything. Especially in our culture today, what you say means very little. People say a lot. It's what you do. Now, it's easy to laugh about slander in a situation like that, but what about when the slander is something that actually matters? You know, what about when it's your reputation at work that's being slandered? What about when it's your reputation in the neighborhood or in the community? What about when it's your character that's being attacked or your motives and intent that's being attacked? That's a lot harder to handle. Peter's audience were being accused of being evildoers. People were saying that essentially they're not good. They're essentially evil. And in their culture, slander like that, this is the kind of slander that can get you killed. There's no laughing matter at all. And so what are they supposed to do? People are talking trash about them, and it's not right, and it's not fair, and it's dangerous. What are they supposed to do? I think what you'll see really comes across through 1 Peter is that it's okay to defend yourself. Later, he tells them to have a defense ready. It's okay to defend yourself, but actions speak much louder than words, and that's where he really puts his emphasis, is you just have to pay attention to how you're going to be, and he says that your behavior should be excellent. And that word's very important. It's not okay behavior. He's not saying have passable, you know, decent behavior. Have excellent behavior. And I think that the idea here is because we're aligned with Christ, the cornerstone, who's the rejected cornerstone, you know, because we are going to stand out. And often we're going to stand out in a negative way. Last week we said the gospel is offensive. People are going to be offended if we say that we believe in God. And because of that fact, you know, there are places where we really stand out. But there are many other places where we overlap with culture. And he's saying in those places, we better excel. I'm going to get negative press for following Christ no matter what. So in the places where we agree with culture, why not wow them? We both agree this is good, and I'm going to excel in that area. Because of your good deeds, as they observe them, as they see who you are, that this may correct their misconceptions about you. And then he says this, that they might glorify God. Isn't that an interesting leap? They're accusing you, so watch your behavior so that they might glorify God. We can correct misconceptions about Christ because there's something connected between our corporate reputation really is Christ's reputation. We are his representatives in this world. And so when we show who he really is, well, that's what we need to do, is show who he really is. And so that's what's at stake here. And he says that they may glorify God in the day of visitation, which is really interesting. He's putting this in the context of the return of Christ. You know, excellent behavior isn't God's ultimate goal. That's not God's end game, is to get everyone behaving well. His goal is the rescue of the entire human race. And excellent behavior is our strategy for navigating this difficult time. And he's reminding them that there will be a day when, you know, Jesus has come once and visited us, and he will again visit. There will be a second coming of Christ. And the picture that he's painting is that on that day, there will be people who are right with God, who glorify God, people who have been reconciled with God because of how we represented him. It's an incredible picture. He's saying, look, you should represent Christ well, and you should pay attention to your behavior in the hopes that people change their mind about God and are saved. That word excellent is actually the word for beautiful or attractive. You should have beautiful behavior. The kind of behavior that people notice and it actually draws them toward you. It's pretty challenging. Jesus certainly taught this. In Matthew 5, he just got done saying that people are going to slander you and say all kinds of lies about you, and not to be surprised by that. He goes on and says, you are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. This world is dark as night, and you have been reconnected with God, and that makes you a light in this world. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Don't you think Peter's just stealing Jesus' teaching here? He totally is. He's allowed to do that. I always think of the light as being the gospel, and I think that I'm sure that that's right. But notice what Jesus says. He says, let your light shine so that they may see your works. Let me see what you do, and as a result, be attracted toward the light and ultimately land on the right conclusion about God himself. Yeah, it's incredible. Well, this was certainly part of what caused the Christian movement to grow in its early days. One of the really interesting things about the Christians during this time is that their movement was expanding at astonishing rates in the first centuries. And that's really surprising and strange because they were enduring all this terrible persecution, being killed for their faith, and yet it's growing. How is that possible? And that's something historians scratch their heads about. And when you read about this, they tend to point out a couple key factors. Okay, one reason that it grew despite persecution was that they tended to really love and accept the rejected people in society. The sick people and the prostitutes and the slaves. People who were rejected found a home in the Christian community. Another reason is because they suffered well. And so when people persecuted them, Christians tended to respond with love and forgiveness, which frankly blew people's mind and attracted them toward the faith. And the other reason is because they served like crazy. And if you had a community of Christians in your community, they were a huge blessing. And you're like, man, how do we get along without these guys? And for those reasons, people decided, I want to be a part of this. One of the best examples that I love to talk about is the Cyprian plague. You guys ever heard of the Cyprian plague? It was this terrible thing that happened in around 250 AD. The Cyprian plague was one of the worst plagues ever. It killed millions of people in Rome. I was reading a guy who said that they estimated that this plague was killing as many as 5,000 people a day in Rome. It might have been the initial introduction of smallpox. People aren't sure, but it was terrible. People thought it was the end of the world. People who wrote back then thought this is the apocalypse. Humanity is done for. Here's a description from Pontius of Carthage, someone who lived through it. Just listen to this, okay? He says, afterwards, there broke out a dreadful plague. An excessive destruction of a hateful disease invaded every house in succession of the trembling populace, carrying off day by day with abrupt attack numberless people, everyone from his own house. All were shuddering, fleeing, shunning the contagion, impiously exposing their own friends, as if with the exclusion of the person who was sure to die of the plague, one could exclude death itself also. You see what he's saying? He's like, people were barring the door. People, if you were sick, they were just throwing you out so that they wouldn't become sick also. Says, there lay about, in the meanwhile, over the whole city, no longer bodies, but the carcasses of many. And by the contemplation of a lot, which in their turn would be theirs, demanded the pity of the passers-by for themselves. They're not even burying the dead. And he's describing people walking by and not even having pity on the dead, but pity on themselves, like, that's going to be me. That's what he's describing. No one regarded anything beside his cruel gains. No one trembled at the remembrance of a similar event. No one did to another what he himself wished to experience. It's every man for himself. They were in full walking dead mode here. And the Romans, of course, blamed this on the Christians. Now, talk about a PR nightmare, okay? That's bad press. The end of the world, and they're blaming the Christians. There was rumors going around at the times that Christians were creepy, you know, that they were cannibals was one rumor, that they were incestuous, that they hated mankind and wished for the end of the world, and people said the Christians are getting what they wanted. Now, what would you say if I told you that this same period where Christians were being blamed for this was also one of the periods of explosive growth of the Christian church? Does that surprise you? Why? It's because the Christians took this as an opportunity to show who they really were. And when all this was happening, it was the Christians who were out there burying the dead, tending to the sick. They weren't afraid to die. Many of them believed that it was the end of the world too. And so they faced it with hope. And people were so blown away by this. Here, this is Cyprian, who was a Christian, a bishop. This is his description. And listen how different it is. You know it's going to be a good quote when the first word is bowels. Hope you're not eating. Bowels relaxed into a constant flux. Discharge the bodily strength, that the intestines are shaken with continual vomiting, that the eyes are on fire with the injected blood, that in some cases the feet or some parts of the limbs are taken off by the contagion of diseased putrefaction, that from the weakness arising by the maiming and loss of the body, either the gait is enfeebled or the hearing obstructed or the sight darkened, is profitable as proof of faith. Here's this nightmare that we are all facing. And he says there's profit in it, though. Not that the plague was good, but that it could be, but there's a silver lining, he's saying. And what is that? That it proves our faith. What a grandeur of spirit it is to struggle with all the powers of an unshaken mind against so many onsets of devastation and death. What sublimity to stand erect amid the desolation of the human race and not to lie prostrate with those who have no hope in God, but rather to rejoice and embrace the benefit of the occasion, that in thus bravely showing forth our faith and by suffering endured, going forward to Christ by the narrow way that Christ trod, we may receive the reward of his life and faith according to his own judgment. He's like, here's our chance to stand out. We don't have no hope in God. We don't have to be afraid. We can stand tall when everyone else is on their knees. Okay, I don't know about you. I find that incredibly challenging. I mean, I'd bar the door, probably, is what I would be doing. They're out there serving. Our deeds can reverse false ideas about Christ. Try saying that the Christians hate humanity after that. After they're out there rescuing you from this illness, putting themselves at risk. That rumor would evaporate, wouldn't it? Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And you're like, okay, yeah, but Ben, but nobody's saying that we're cannibals. You know, like, nobody's accusing us of the terrible things they were accusing them of. And that's true. You're right. I've never been accused of being a cannibal. I mean, it could happen. In our world, it could totally happen. But so far, so good. No one is saying we're cannibals, but what they are saying is that we're boring and old-fashioned and irrelevant and weird. You believe in the Bible? You take that literally? Oh, that's weird. That's a little bit dangerous. And narrow-minded and intolerant and judgy and repressive and controlling and pushy and suspicious. You know, that suspicion that at the end of the day, we're really not out for love, but where there's some ulterior motive and it's weird and I don't like it. Christians are either dumb or they're up to no good and I'm not sure which, but either way, I don't like it. That's pretty common. This list was easy for me to think of. I just thought about the things that I thought about Christians before I was one, and that's what they were. And you know what changed my mind about all those things up there? It wasn't anyone talking me out of them. It was getting around Christians and seeing that it wasn't so. You know, it was coming in. Look, the gospel was hard for me to believe at first. And I was pretty defensive, like, I don't want to get beat over the head or judged for what I believe. I was pretty surprised to actually dialogue with Christians and find them curious and find them, intellectually honest and fair and up for a great conversation and not judging me for what I thought or for who I was and for the many problems in my life. But accepting me and talking to me, and then it was like they weren't, you know, I was expecting them to be weird. They weren't that weird. They were not more weird than anyone else that I had already been friends with. They were an average amount of weird. Not these things that I had in my mind. Not judging me. And so I was like, oh, and not boring too. You know, I expected it to be like, well, whatever. I'm never throwing in with Christians. I've got way better things to do. And then I discovered, you know, here's this community of people that are excited, that are motivated, that are countercultural, that are together trying to do good and make an impact in the world. And pretty soon I was like, I have to be involved in this. I have to be a part of it. It was what they did. That's what changed my mind. Here's a good thought experiment. What do people say about you? What do you think your neighbors think about you? They think something. Especially if they know that you're about Christ, trust me, you're like, oh, that's not that provocative. It's provocative. If you're out there saying, my life is all about Christ, people are wondering what is up with you. And what do they think about you? Now, they might think bad things about you that are true. But they might think bad things about you that are misconceptions. And if that's the case, then we have to show them what's true in what we do. Do your actions refute the misconceptions that people have about Christ? People think wrong things about Christ all the time. And does your life speak directly against that? Or does it confirm those things? What does the way you live your life communicate to the watching world? I love that expression. That's from Francis Schaeffer, this idea that people are wondering about us. We make a bold claim that Christ was God, that this is the way of salvation. Man, that is a bold claim. And if we're going to make a claim like that, we better be able to back it up with a bold life that looks a lot, it should look a lot different than an average life, right? What does my life say? What are you known for outside your church community? Okay, you see how I worded that? Outside. So like at church, you're the encourager and you keep the prayer list. But at work, what? You're the crabber, you know, or the tyrant or the weird loner. It's important to think about. If I went to your work and asked people about you, what would they say? And what would that say about Christ? Are your neighbors glad you live there? Glad, not tolerant, but glad you live there. That's one of the best ways. Some friends of mine and I just read this book, The Art of Neighboring, which they have out there. It's great. And it hit home to me that it's like, this is a way that all of us can show Christ. Here's an area of strong overlap with our culture. It's good to be a good neighbor. Everyone in our culture thinks that, and we think it too. So that's a place where we should excel. You should be the best neighbor on the block. You should learn their names, the people who live around you. You should invite them over for dinner. You should host a block party. I've got a friend who just remodeled their front porch, and he's like, here's my vision for my porch, that we're sitting out here every night, and as the neighbors go by, we're saying hi and talking to them. And then he put a mini fridge on his porch. I was like, what's that for? And he's like, this is a beer fridge to offer a beer to my friends when they come by. I was like, dude, that is next level neighboring right there. Do you put a high time and resource priority on helping other people around you? You know, am I ready to drop what I'm doing and my agenda? Is my life so filled with stuff for me that there's nothing for anyone else? Or am I expecting to give a good deal of my time and money and energy into doing good around me for other people? In my community and in the world and serving the poor? There's so many opportunities. Probably many people in your home church are involved in all kinds of different things that you could easily jump into. This stuff really matters. That's why we're doing that big community festival in 2 weeks. Why are we doing that big festival? Because we're trying to tell our community that we love them. And that we're not that weird. Average weird. A little below average, but whatever, you get the point. These are ways that we can get out there and show people through what we do. Now, he's going to give them two concrete examples in their experience. Here's the first one. Starting in 13, he says, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. So he says, all right, first thing, submit to human authorities, to kings or governors. How should I interact with king, with the one, with the government and authority? You should submit, he says. And the reason he gives, we know from Scripture, he says it's the will of God. This is right. Now look, human governments are fallen. They're part of the fallen world. They do evil. Sometimes they do great evil. But that governments exist, that's good. God's like, I'm into that. Order is better than chaos. And in a world that isn't fallen, there would be human authority. And their part would be to govern fairly and well, and your part would be to submit. Do your part. And then he tells them the reason why. That by doing right, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. There was a rumor about them. There was a slander against Christians that they were anti-Rome, that they were secretly wanting to tear down the Roman government and subvert in that way. And this was because in Rome, it was cool to worship the emperor. People did that. They would give token sacrifices and things, worship him as a deity. And the Christians were like, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to worship a man. And so they abstained from that, and that was suspicious. You know, people were like, whoa, are you going to diss Caesar? You know, but these Christians, they're creepy. And they're going to get us in trouble, and they're going to get us all killed because you don't mess with Caesar. And so there was concern about them, and so he's saying, guys, in order to silence that's a slander, but in order to silence it, you should submit. Show them that they've got you wrong. And why should you show them that? For the Lord's sake. It's back to Christ's reputation that's on the line. He's not worried about Caesar and his well-being. He's worried about what people say about Christ, and let's not muddy the waters by having people think that Jesus is an anti-Caesar movement, because that's not what it's about. It's a pro-gospel movement, not an anti-Caesar movement, and so make sure they got that straight by being an excellent citizen. Then he gives them a little more. He says, act as free men, and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bondslaves of God. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. So he reminds them about their freedom. Act as free men. You know, guys, if you're in Jesus Christ, you have incredible freedom because you've been made right with God. So what do you have to worry about? You're free from the law. You don't have to earn acceptance, because you already have that. You're free from the opinions of other people. And you're free from human authority, because you answer to the ultimate authority. No authority has power over you that is higher than God, and that's who you stand before. You have total freedom, and yes, you have freedom from Caesar. You're a child of God. But what are you going to do with that freedom? You could go out, he says, don't use it as a covering for evil. You could go out and steal and commit all kinds of crimes. You're like, well, I don't answer to Caesar, I answer to God, and I'm cool with him. Okay, yes, you could do that with your freedom, but would that really be honoring God? No, he says, don't use it as a covering for evil, but as bondslaves of God. And I know that that word bondslaves is a turnoff in our culture. Just know that Peter is saying that with pride. He's saying, look, you all serve somebody. You serve Caesar, or you serve your slave master, or you serve your own lusts. You're a slave to something, but I have chosen to make myself a slave of the one person who is worthy of my whole life, the one who died for me, the righteous king. I'm a slave of him. And I'm going to act like it, and he's good, and that's how I'm going to be. And then he gives them this little saying. I love this verse, verse 17. They would sometimes crystallize teachings into little sayings that you could memorize. I think a lot of Christians would do well to memorize this verse and live by it. This, you know, if you're confused about how to navigate politics and government and all that, this verse will take you pretty far. He says, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Honor all people, which was totally radical at the time. They didn't, in Rome, it was stratified. Some people were definitely more valuable than others. But God says, no, you're all valuable. Sick people are valuable the same as healthy people. Men are valuable the same as women. Slaves the same as slave masters. They're all made in my image and they're valuable. That was totally radical. And I know it's not radical to you because you learned that in elementary school, that all men are created equal. But just know that it got its start here. This is Judeo-Christian values and they come from God. Honor all people. And then he goes a step up, but love the brotherhood. One another, we have to do more than honor each other. We have to love each other. We have to give ourselves for each other. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God. That's the highest. Fear God. The ultimate reverence is reserved for God. And then honor the king, which goes back down. You see that? Do you see that the word for a king is the same with people? Honor everybody and honor the king, just the same as you honor everybody. Give him the honor he's due. But that's nothing compared to fearing God. This is, he's putting our priorities in order. The most important thing should be fearing God, and the political situation is a secondary concern, is what he's saying. And guys, I think this is an area where we can really stand out. I know you're all on pin. I see it. You're afraid of what I'm going to say. Everyone's like, oh God, oh God, oh God. Relax. All I'm going to say about this is our culture is not behaving well in this area. That's not controversial. Everyone agrees. Everyone's alarmed, okay, by everything that's happening on both sides, on all sides. It's crazy. And that puts Christians in a really weird spot because people are in us versus them mode, probably more than ever, or it seems like more than ever. And we don't really fit the mold perfectly on any side. And so we tend, for a lot of people, to look like them more than we look like us. It puts us in a very weird place that's hard to navigate. And so what should I do? What should I do? Well, you could do exactly what our culture does, which is to pick one side and be like, this is all that matters. This is salvation that my side wins. And so I'm going to go on Facebook and bash my neighbor into submission. You could do that. But guys, that's not our Savior. That's not what your neighbor needs. Your neighbor needs Christ. And we don't need to put our hope in men. We need to put our hope in God. Yes, you should honor the king, which in our society means you should be a good citizen. You should follow the laws. You should have an opinion. This is a democracy. You should vote. You should have meaningful, constructive dialogue with people you disagree with and honor them while you do it. You should do all of those things. But you know what's way more important than that? That you fear God. That is the correctly ordered priority. That my main thing, my hope is in God. I'm not hoping in a political outcome. I'm hoping in the day of visitation. When the true king returns, who's going to put every human political solution to shame. That's my hope. And when we do that, I think that we really can stand out. You know, a really cool thing about Xenos Christian Fellowship, this year we took a survey, when you've never done this, of all kinds of questions about the people who come to this church. And of the thousands of people who come to this church, we asked about their political leanings, and guess what? It came out pretty much right down the middle, which I think is really cool. Because it tells me we've got a church that does this. We have a church of people who are unified in Christ, many of whom disagree about how to honor the king. Disagree about that, but we agree on something way more importantly, and we agree on that unanimously, which is that we fear God and we follow him. And that's what matters. And that can actually bring us together under that banner. People of all kinds, not just political differences, but racial and socioeconomic differences and personality differences and everything else, we can all come under the umbrella of Jesus Christ and be unified, and that is beautiful behavior. I think when people look at that, they say, that's different and that's refreshing. And the result is that people are drawn to Christ. Okay, he gives him another example. He says, servants. This passage just keeps getting deeper. Now we're going to talk about slaves. Hope you prayed for me this week. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect. Not only those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. Okay, he's talking about slaves. And this was important because many people in Roman society were slaves. Some people estimate as many as one-third of all people in Rome had slave status. And Christianity was spreading through the slaves and slave masters, interestingly. And so many Christians are like, well, I'm a slave, so what do I do? What's it look like for me to have excellent behavior? And he tells them, be submissive to your master. No one's favorite verse. Well, what is this? So what? Paul's down with slavery? Well, okay, real quick, a little context. First of all, or not Paul, Peter. The Bible, the New Testament is radical in its anti-slavery. Okay? Paul told people, if you are a slave and you can get your freedom, take it. He urged slave masters to free their slaves as brothers in Christ. You have verses like Galatians 3. There's neither Jew nor Greek. There's neither slave nor free man. There's neither male nor female, for you're all one in Christ Jesus. The world had never seen anything like this movement where you have slaves sitting next to rich, important people, and they're sitting together studying the word as brothers and equals. That was completely new, and frankly, it was pretty scary. It rocked the boat. You know, this threatened to undermine the whole economic structure of Rome. And so the question here is, you know, what should they do? You can see why a lot of Christians who were slaves might come to the conclusion like, gee, maybe I should demand equal treatment because I'm, after all, a child of God. Maybe I should buck this system. And so that's why he's writing to them about their situation. Here's the key insight is that a slave uprising, while it may be justified, it definitely would have been justified, but it also would have been counterproductive. In Roman history, there had been numerous slave uprisings, and they all resulted in the slaughter of the people who had risen up. They called these the servile wars. Maybe you've heard of like Spartacus and those stories. In the last servile war, which had happened a century earlier, all the slaves who rose up were killed, and the final 6,000 were rounded up and were crucified, lining a road for miles, every one of them as a reminder of what happens if you stand up against Rome. And so Peter's like, no, 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 don't do that. It's not time for that. It would be counterproductive because we're on mission. Our mission is to proclaim the gospel, the light in the dark world, and rescue those who are lost. Yeah, slavery is an abomination. Slavery is bad. But if we make our mission to end slavery, first of all, we probably won't succeed. That's not going to succeed for thousands of years later. But even if they did succeed, the result would be slavery would be over, and the world would still be lost and headed to hell. He's saying our priority is to proclaim the gospel. And guess what? When that happens, you know what also tends to come with it? The end of slavery. Because when people come to Christ, they begin to see others as their equal. That's the best way to beat slavery. And that's exactly what he's telling them to do. What you guys should do is try to wow your master and win his heart. Win him to Christ. That's the mission. You see this very clearly, passages like Titus 2. He says, urge bond slaves to be subject to their own masters in everything, to be well-pleasing, not argumentative, not pilfering or stealing, but showing all good faith so that they will adorn the doctrine of God, our Savior, in every respect. The picture here is let your behavior adorn your message and win people's hearts. And then it gets even deeper, the water. Not only those who are good and gentle, but also those who are unreasonable. Peter, so I'm supposed to submit to my master, and if he treats me like dirt, I'm just not supposed to do anything? Supposed to be a doormat? Passages like this make me just want to close the Bible and go play a video game. You know what I mean? You're studying, you're like, come on, really? Yeah. That's what he's saying. And maybe this is something that's been bothering you this whole teaching. There is an elephant in the living room in this teaching. Maybe that's why a lot of you are glaring at me. There's an elephant in the living room, and that is, yeah, okay, doing right, doing good. That's fine. That's all well and good, Ben. But what about when doing good means suffering unjustly? You say I should be a good citizen. Well, that's easy to do when the person I voted for wins. But what about when the person that I didn't vote for wins? It's a little bit harder, or a lot harder. You say that I should be a good employee at work. Well, what? You don't know my boss. You know, my boss is a jerk. You say I should be a good neighbor. My neighbors are terrible. You know, like, he's telling them to submit to Rome. Do you know who Caesar of Rome was during this time? It was Nero. Do you remember from the first week? Neckbeard? Nero? The psychotic, most, you know, murderous hater of Christians ever. Nero probably killed Peter a few years after he wrote this letter. And he's like, yeah, you should submit and honor him. What? Come on. That's the but wait, but wait. It actually gets worse. When he sums up this whole segment later, he says, to sum up, all of you be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. When someone insults you, he says, don't give an insult back, give him a blessing. Man, evil for evil and insult for insult, that's Twitter, okay? That is Twitter. He's saying, when that comes to you, you give a blessing back instead. How can he ask us to do this? How can he ask this of them? Again, he's just ripping off Jesus' material. Matthew 5:39, Jesus says, if someone slaps you on the right cheek, or the other, offer the other cheek also. If you're sued in court and your shirt is taken from you, give your coat too. If a soldier demands that you carry his gear for a mile, carry it too. I say, love your enemies. They had a law in Rome that the soldiers could demand anyone carry their gear for up to a mile, and you had to comply. And the Jews bitterly hated this. Jesus says, when that happens, carry it too. Do more than what's right. Man. Well, we've got a lot of questions about this, and Peter anticipates these in our last little section here. He says, for this finds favor, if for the sake of conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. For what credit is there if, when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? But when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it. This finds favor with God. He's saying when you are being treated unfairly and you endure it and you do so for the sake of conscience toward God, this finds favor. That God notices that. God says, I see the sacrifice you're making for my sake, and I have noted that. In other words, when you choose to endure injustice for his sake, God takes notice, and you're exchanging the favor of men for the favor of God. They may slander you and hate you. They may mistreat you. But when you give them back not just what's right, but what's more than right, and it is not fair, when you go through that and it is not fair, God's like, I saw that you did that, and I saw that it wasn't fair, and I'm going to make it right. That's why he says, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing for, it's the because you were called for this very purpose, that you might inherit a blessing. God's like, listen, guys, get the person in your mind who wronged you most recently. Don't, if they're in the room, don't look at you because they're going to know you're thinking about it. Get them in your mind. The person from who you have suffered injustice. And now imagine giving them a blessing. It just won't compute, right? He says, when you do that for my sake, for the sake of my reputation, I will pay you back for that. That's why it's hard. That's why enduring injustice is hard, is because it's faith. Would you rather get even with that person in your mind? Or would you rather get a blessing from God? And you're like, get even with them. I'd rather get even. I know, but think about it's a blessing from God, okay? It's pretty good. Think about it. If you were at the OSU game and a player unrighteously spiked a football and it flew up and hit you in the nose and bloodied your nose, and you were mad. And then Urban Meyer came out of somewhere and was like, hey, I saw what happened. And it wasn't right. And you know what? I'd like to make it up to you. I have something special in mind. What would you do? Would you take that? Or would you be like, screw you, Urban Meyer, and rush the field and try to beat that dude up? I mean, you could do that, but it wouldn't be smart, and it wouldn't go well, and it wouldn't get you what you want anyway. You can live your life like that, guys. You can live your life like, I'm going to go out into this world and get what I deserve. People are going to treat me right. Damn it, people are going to give me exactly the respect and honor that I deserve. You can go and do that, but you're not going to get it. One. And two, you're going to miss out on this opportunity, which is that when someone deals you a curse, you can deal them a blessing and watch hearts melt and watch people turn to Christ and have their lives and eternity changed. That's the power that we have here. That's why we patiently endure it. He says, you've been called for this purpose. This is part of the mission he has for you, is this. Since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his footsteps. Yeah, this is the example that we've been given by Christ. This is exactly how Christ lived his life. Who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats. That's true. Here's the one guy who never sinned, the one person who never deserved any harsh treatment, who was treated worse than anyone, and he didn't fight back. What did he do? He said, forgive them, Father, they know not what they do. He gave them a blessing. How did he do that? It said he kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. There's a deep insight right there. The Son, how did he endure that injustice? How did he endure the cross? He endured the cross by trusting his Father, who is the righteous judge, who sees everything and who will make everything right. Every injustice will ultimately be answered before God, either by the person who perpetrated it, or if they've trusted Christ to pay for their sins, then Christ will stand in their place. But there will be justice for every wrong done. And he's asking them to put their faith in that and defer justice. Yeah, your slave master is mistreating you. So defer justice to the one true judge and trust that he's going to take care of that. And now you can love them. This is so difficult. Romans 12, dear friends, never take revenge. Leave that to the righteous anger of God. For the scriptures say, I will take revenge. I will pay them back, says the Lord. Instead, if your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they are thirsty, give them something to drink. And in doing this, you will heap burning coals of shame on their heads. Don't let evil conquer you, but conquer evil by doing good. Guys, this is something that we can do. This is our superpower in Christ. Because, don't neglect these two little words in this passage right here. He says, Christ also suffered for you. That's a very important detail. Loving your enemies, that's exactly what Jesus did for you. What about the evil that I've perpetrated? What about the people who I have been unjust to? Jesus paid for my guilt as well. He suffered injustice for you. And the more you think about that, when you look at the cross, and there's Jesus in my place paying for what I did, that's not fair, right? That's the ultimate injustice. And I'll tell you, the longer you look at that picture, the looser your grip gets on what's fair and what's owed to you in this life. Don't forget that Jesus suffered for you and that he's loved you in a way that you never deserved. And because you've been loved in a way that you never deserved, you can go out into this life and love people in a way that they don't deserve either. Think about it, guys. Our mission is to love people who hate God and who hate us a lot of times too. If we're going to do that, then we have to have a thick enough skin. We have to trust God enough to endure some hate. If you can't endure, if you can't take some grief from people, then you can't love them. This is not a picture of doormats who are too weak to defend themselves. This is a picture of confident people who have the added capacity and power to lay down our rights for the sake of ungluing other people's pride. This is something that we have. And it's something that if we live our lives this way, I believe it will change the world. God, thank you for this this super difficult passage. You challenge our thinking, but you also equip us to endure trials and slander. And this world is going to deal us curses, God. There's no way around that. We're going to receive curses just because it's the fallen world, and we're going to receive extra curses because we are following you. And thanks that you anticipate that. You give us something to stand in, and you give us a hope that can shine bright in this dark world. Help us to do that, Lord. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.